Okay, without further ado, Bob Reddick. Thank you.
First of all, thank you all for inviting me here. And then just a little plug for our little church, All Our One Roman Catholic Church, is the board also just today, they authorized money to go to the Doctors Without Borders for Gaza and the Palestinians. Okay, now all I have to do is remember my life up to this point. The program says, part of what I said was the journey. And that starts in order to change 180, 179 degrees, let's say, you have to have a basis. And that comes with being born in 1946, going to an 8-country school with 8 grades, learning all our Minnesota history, world history, U.S. history, how the government works, civics, and being patriotic, especially in 1957 when the Sputnik went up. We concentrated then on math and science. And then moving on, I went to Cotter where the Franciscan sisters and lay teachers first taught us to have principles and then start the inklings of thinking and questioning. And because of my parents, who were not activists, not extremists in any way, but good, solid American citizens, generally backing the government, where it went, and the people, we moved on to the seminary because we had young priests at that time, and were good examples. Even though my dad didn't encourage me to go or anything, family always supported me. So in the seminary, which was based, it was another dorm, but a community on St. Mary's College, at that time college, and only men, was a natural step. And in that community and in that process, which was very good, we also I was fortunate to get a liberal arts education from St. Mary's College at that time. And that also began the time of starting to question and think. So as we progressed to 1968, I realized that in a closed community and with not a co-ed campus, my social life was limited, etc. And I also realized that before I wanted to go on to be a priest, I had to mature and grow up. And so I asked for a leave of absence, which was denied because they had a bounty of vocations, and so they could be a little picky. And so I said I have to just have some time off. So halfway through my senior year, then came the question of what do you do? And at that time, I was in the situation where I was questioning, but when a U.S. jet got shot down over Vietnam, I still felt it and felt bad. So that was the stage I was at. And in the Tonkin Gulf resolution, I didn't question it. Didn't realize that governments can be deceptive. So the question came up as to whether to go into the Air Force, as I was always interested in flying. I wasn't a pilot then, or something else like the Peace Corps. And that was probably where the conscience and thinking and questioning first kicked in, seriously. And that was the first major decision. And in fact, my good friend, who left for the same reasons at the same time, did go into the Air Force. He did become a pilot. I met him in Vietnam later. He was flying cargo planes. Later on, he flew B-52s that bombed in the areas where some of my people were. And then later, he was in the Strategic Air Command with carrying nuclear weapons over North America as a deterrent. And so over the years, we'd always argue about these things. So intellectually, the questioning was there. And then I went in the Peace Corps. I served in India, not the full 2 years, because we were in West Bengal. West Bengal is what they call a very activist state in India. It's 10 years ahead, it used to be 10 years ahead of the rest of India. And so they were very active, and there was a lot of activity. And so politically, it was unstable. And even though I was in a secure place out in the country, we had the option to leave. And also, at that time, that was my first experience as being the only white person among all kinds of other Indians. And to be all by yourself, which I think is an experience everybody should try and have, go to a foreign country or somewhere else, be the only one that's totally different, and then you operate in that society. So that's very sobering. I learned Bengali, and my program was agricultural, to speak to the farmers, essentially push miracle rice, wheat, and the herbicides, which are banned now, and the seeds to produce it. And so there was some question about that also. But in the process of being there and seeing the United States from the outside, the war was going on at that time very heavily. I think Tet Offensive was that spring. The My Lai Massacre took place at that time. The thinking then was very much aware of this, that I could have stayed in India for probably 2 or 3 more years and hit out. And the problem was I couldn't do that, because then the idea of the war became real. Before it was intellectual when I made the decision. India became real because I could see the United States with untainted eyes or from the outside. And then it became me. And also at the same time, we were a poor family. We had gotten running water in the house, but we didn't have, and actually had a septic tank and stuff put in, but no place to put a bathroom. And so I realized, here I am. I could have sat comfortably in the middle of India, out in the countryside, but I couldn't, because of conscience. And so I came home, and of course by this time I had had so many deferments from the draft board that they weren't about to give me another one. And so I got the 1A, which meant I was eligible for induction. So at that point, then went back to helping my dad on the farm, and essentially designing and building with him and my sisters and mother a major addition to the house, tearing off part of the house. Probably one of the hardest construction projects for a newbie. It'd been much easier to build a new house. So we were so involved in that. I got my 1A. I went to the draft board, and at that point, because it had become real to me, not just intellectual, it became me. Then I applied for the 1-0, or conscientious objection status. And the draft board would always be split, so some people were supporting. Okay, now the biggest problem in becoming a conscientious objector is, you know, what you believe, what your history has been all through your life, and changing that, telling that to others, but then asking, what does this really mean? Because the rules are, you can't object to a specific war. So even having a question about Vietnam, then you can't say, well, if you think World War II is a good war, which is an oxymoron, or a just war is an oxymoron, it's like a black-white or a square circle, you can't. So that was the pivoting question, is, do I conscientiously object to all wars? And that was the thing I was working on that summer. And then, not quite like Paul getting struck down by lightning, I realized, hey, I do object to all war, consciously object to all war. And I think probably everyone here does. I don't think anybody here is in favor of war. And so realizing that and having internalized, then the question is, what do you do? Because I had a 1A, draft board had turned down the 1-0, and they said, they charged me in federal court, gave me a court date to appear to state my case. So I I got a lawyer, and he says, gather all the information, get references. Some people, that neighbors that were opposed to what my thinking, but gave me a great reference, you know, character reference. And so we had a fairly good case, and I was comfortable with that. I wrote the government or the draft board or whoever that I was, and at that point too, I was not going to run. I was going to stay and make a issue of it, a point of it, and I was comfortable with going to jail if you can be comfortable with that as a consequence. So we set it up, we get the case set up. All of a sudden, in the mail comes the 1-0. So essentially, I had called the federal government's bluff. They dropped the case. And the reason they dropped it, because at this time, in the timeline of the war, earlier on they didn't. Bob Gillum was an early, he was from Cotter graduate, he was an early conscientious objector. He went to prison. Joe Morris, I'm not sure when he got it or how he got it, but he was the same, you know, was the same situation. But as progressed, as the conscience of the country was starting to shift, the whole country is starting to shift, and not the rampant or easy support of the war, the time was such that they did not want the publicity because I had a pretty strong case, even though I had had 100 deferments before that, essentially. So then what happened, and this was probably in, what, 70, so I get this in the mail, and it's like, now what do I do? So... yeah, what do I do? Yeah, you know, I've got it. This is what I so I started looking around, and because we had speakers from the American Friends Service Committee, the Quakers, which had planted some of that, St. Mary's College had planted some of the ideas or the questions. So I talked with them, and they said, "We know we have an opening in Nigeria." And I thought, well, that's, you know, good service. And then they said, but we also have an opening in Vietnam. They have a rehabilitation center in actually quite near, well, the hotspot in Quang Ngai, which is up in the middle of the South Vietnam. It's a rehabilitation center because any civilians wounded in the war could not get rehabilitation for any limbs that were blown off, and reconstruction, physical therapy, could not get that, and only the military people were that got taken care of. And if you were male, you were in the military, supposedly, or else you were wounded. I mean, or else you were wounded and not able to fight on the other side. So that seemed, and so a little bit of a fun part of it, it was very nice to go to the draft board and ask them if I could go to Vietnam. Because there was a real feeling that you should go, and especially as a Catholic, you should fight, because Catholics, having been discriminated against in the early times of our country, tried to always be in the leading in the wars to prove that they were patriotic. So being a Catholic was actually a detriment to getting a CO, ironically. And a Lutheran friend of mine who's in the Peace Corps, he got his conscientious objection status, you know, just easily. So it depends on the place and all that. So they granted me and it was real nice to go to the draft board because some had always supported it. So they gave me permission to do my alternate service in Vietnam, which is what I did. And then that really increased and hardened the conscientious objection status. Now, you know, a big point I want to make is that being a conscientious objector does not mean you're necessarily a pacifist. Even though I believe pacifism is probably the most effective way for change, and the biggest examples are the civil rights movement in the United States and India with Gandhi. So it is most effective, but it's not easy. And so the question the draft board asked is, well, what would you do then if somebody's attacking your wife, or somebody, if everybody felt that way? I said, well, if everybody felt that way, there'd be nobody to fight. They were assuming it'd be on one side. And that's essentially the truth. Or as a Whereas Bob Gillum, I think, said that somebody asked him, well, what if somebody's attacking your wife or somebody? He said, well, I would put myself in between or say, attack me. So, and that's essentially the hardest lesson. So where does that leave us today after whatever, 50 some years of it? And so essentially I still have the same feeling and belief, and it is relevant today more so than ever because of the ongoing conflicts in the world is how do you deal with it? And the other thing is to very much be aware, everybody, because for example, because Milai and Kathy, we went back later, she was there too, where the civilians were murdered. And you say, how can somebody do that? You would say, I cannot do that. Well, if you were in the situation where it's hot and damp and you're miserable, your buddies that are close to you have been murdered or killed in the thing, and your commander gives you an order to invade a village which you're taking fire from and people are getting killed, what would you do at that time? So that's a big personal question to ask with pacifism. How would you react? And the honest truth is, I don't know. Any questions? Did I leave anything out, Kathy? Okay.
Any questions?
Well, that's good. It's all settled. No, it isn't. Actually, I didn't. and actually, I was called what was a generalist. So in other words, I did. I learned Vietnamese. 2019, we had to do it. And so it was. And then so I did all the. Our main people were the doctors, one doctor, the physical therapist, and the prosthetist. And we had an English fellow prosthetist who was training Vietnamese to do the prosthetics to make the arms, legs, feet, whatever, and the and then the physical therapists, they were training mostly Vietnamese women to be physical therapists. And so we had physical therapists training them, and then also the English fella training Roger Marshall, English fella. But he was doing all the training. So my job was to do payroll, do maintenance. I had a crew to keep the facilities going. We were on the campus of the hospital, the regional hospital, which is you don't vision it as a hospital. It was a mess. But and then ordering supplies, and that's hard, that's years out kind of time. It's been trying to, you know, get the chemicals or the resins, epoxies, that's up from Switzerland to get donated. So essentially just keeping all the work, necessary work, but not the actual important, you know, medical work. The other interesting thing to point out is that because of the war, children are not getting polio vaccinations. So many times they would get polio, their limbs would be, the muscles or tendons are contracted. So our doctor would have to release them, and then they would make braces for these children. And then also in any country, you have just natural things like cooking fires. I mean, a lot of it was war-related, but just the general things in this population. So we do all those things. And the big thing really was the American Friends Service Committee was to have a group of people in the middle of it as a witness. We lived right out in the community. We didn't have any special protection other than like the CIA compound. They had big towers on all corners, big walls, and gun emplacements, and we had just a simple gate that I could throw my bicycle over in the morning to go riding. So primarily, and on the gate was their sign, a broken rifle, you know, like this, and no firearms were allowed in there and things like that. But essentially it was to get information, witness, and we also, with dialogue, because of our British fellow was also a soldier, English soldier in the Suez Canal and all this and that. So he was a very good liaison with the military. So we had a lot of support and things from individual American soldiers that were there.
My other question is, if you had to go to court for the one hole, what kind of materials do you bring to support your case?
Generally, what you bring is character references, so that you, which, and that was important with a good neighbor, a close neighbor who knew me all my life, didn't agree with me at all because her son had been in the military, etc. And a good character reference that says essentially for your character, and not all people would. Some of my friends, even though I knew my character, wouldn't do it, which is a little disappointing. And then I was just gather all the records, your history, so on and so forth. And like I said, the history of being a Catholic was a detriment, which is ironic.
I have a question. I have my own mic. I have a question. I thought there was a question in the back. Bob, I was a CO as well, and I was in the last class to be drafted and all that stuff.
Oh, yeah.
How is your position, how is your feeling, your belief, your thoughts, your position, etc., changed now, 50 years later?
Yeah, that's what I was thinking. Yeah, as I was thinking about the talk, and Tomas here, to his credit, was coaching me and giving pointers, you know, as to rehearsing and stuff. And I figured, well, I don't have to rehearse because this is my life, and I can pretty much, and then Kathy can prompt me. So I was thinking about that. Where are we now? What does that mean? And it's actually exactly the same place. I still am where I am. And at the same time, to be perfectly honest, you know, situation arose, and you're in it, and as in the Second World War, something that started a long time ago happens. What do you do then in the middle? You know, in the middle of that, and that's why I use the Mila example, and that's also my personal question. But my feelings are exactly the same, and it's a tough job.
How about in the workplace, this kind of approach to life, how did that play out in the workplace the rest of your life?
Good question, actually, because I was employed sometimes apprenticing as an electrician. That's my field, electrical contractor. It really didn't at all. And in fact, it played out because I contract jobs for Kendall Lumber Company, and they were sponsoring, or either the Baptist Church or Dean Cornwell were sponsoring Vietnamese. And so when I was working, I would work. They'd ask me, well, can you work with this Vietnamese fellow? I said, yes, I speak some Vietnamese, and so things like that. But generally, no backlash or anything. You know, that way. I'm just trying to think. Yeah, and that is, of course, the question always is, in your personal life, you can look at someone else's life and look at, like the House of Representatives and see, why can't you just get your act together? And or people, and then you're not in their shoes, you know, so that to whatever the backlash, you know, et cetera, would be. I guess just because of all the people I know and work with, that it's never been an issue. And I should mention, too, is in interning, in, you know, like I said, it's not necessarily 180 degrees, but growing. Also, the thing is, my family and my parents, and they had an eighth grade education, both mom and dad, and they raised seven kids, and they adapted rapidly to the changes in the Catholic Church, which was big for them, but they also adapted to my and trusted my letters home of what was going on in India and in Vietnam. So I was fortunate, really, to have, and in the neighborhood, I don't think it was ever an issue. The one funny thing related with it is that in the township, the lowest office in the land is treasurer, the next lowest is clerk. And so in the Wilson Township, the dean of the township, let's say, he got in a little spat with the existing clerk, so he was looking to find someone to run, so he asked me to run, and then he would go around saying, and yeah, he was a CO in the Army, and I didn't correct him. Which was comical. And actually, probably most people today, if you just say CO, don't know that. You have to explain it. All right, thank you all for listening.
I believe we're going to rise as we are able and sing If I Had a Hammer.